of us were actually at the first meeting of the French Conference on Religion and Psychology at Haddonfield in 1943.
That was the Easter weekend in April.
We used to meet in the spring. Not after graduation, but in the spring at meeting houses or at Pendle Hill. The people who were at the first meeting that I know about were Douglas Speer, who was one of the speakers, with Seward Hiltner. And I don't know whether Dorothy was there or not, no. Let's see, who else was here that was there? Chuck was there, and I was there. Anyone else? Others came along a few years later, and some came a great deal later. We had hoped that we would have Elinid Kochany with us, Elinid. But Elinid hasn't been well this spring, and several days ago we had a message that she had quite a bad cold and a cough and couldn't come. And she feels badly and sends her love to all her old friends and wishes us well in our reconstruction of what happened so long ago. We think we were very lucky in having Lucy Ettinger have an interview with Elinid 3 weeks ago. We're planning an article to come out in life and about Elinid, and so Lucy has had a lovely opportunity to talk with Elinid about those early days. She's going to tell us something that happened before the first conference took place. It didn't happen as a full-blown conference. Lots of effort was made, and great visions were held, and lots of negotiations had to be made before the first conference came to be. And Lucy is going to tell us some of what she learned from Elinid.
The title of the first conference was The Nature and Laws of Our Spiritual Life, Our Being Friends. The idea of psychology and religion going together was not exactly accepted at the time. As Elinid said, the psychology had to be brought in, eased in through the back door. Because at that time, and she said one couldn't mention the word psychology, it was suspect. It was thought of as probing, where angels fear to tread, and it was associated with Freud and pathology and crankiness. And she says, this is leaping ahead a bit, but as far as friends, she said that Clarence Pickett came to one of the earlier conferences and he looked around and when he saw waiting friends like Rachel Cameron, he had obviously expected to at this meeting. But the start of Joseph and Agnes Meyer at Chestnut Hill. As she said, through Irene Pickard, she met Joseph and Agnes Meyer, who were studying Jung and others in one of their study groups. And at the Chestnut Hill meeting, she also met Rachel Cadbury. She was in touch with Rachel Cadbury's group at Arch Street, and Dr. Thayer Smith was involved.
Let's ask the editor a little bit about that. That was at the Montclair meeting.
At any rate, these were the groups that combined to have the first meeting at Haddonfield. And for that meeting, Elinid wrote a manifesto but she considers this a challenge to friends to accept the idea of some of the ideas of psychology or some new ideas. I'll read you some of the from the manifesto. The heritage of the Society of Friends in its group religious life, especially in its mode of worship, is a European psychological, now teaching at a great American university, tells the story of his visit to Switzerland, to Swarthmore Race Relations Institute some years ago, and of the tests he carried on for members of different racial groups of the United States. Somewhat to his surprise, all turned out to be alike in exhibiting an inveterate tendency to run away from themselves. There were a few individual exceptions. On inquiries, all of those were discovered to be members of old Quaker families, the result wholly unexpected and unlooked for. Such testimony from a distinguished observer should stir in us much more than complacent self-congratulation. It should light a flame of divine curiosity to understand better why our way of life produces this effect upon those brought up in it. If we fail to understand, we may fail also to preserve and pass along this way of life. Even now, are we not failing short of our efficacy in commending it to the harassed contemporary world, which sorely needs to learn how to live with itself and how to be quiet and know that God is?
That was one of the reasons she felt that we needed, that the Society of Friends needed to relate to people who had an understanding of Jung. I mean, she felt the two were needing each other.
She also said, we know of some who joined the Society of Friends hoping for this very thing and were disappointed and turned to the East for guidance. This is a challenge hard to ignore, turning to the East. She also talked about the training in pastoral psychology that was coming into being at the meetings. We cannot afford to lag behind in availing ourselves of all the knowledge obtainable concerning the perils of the soul. Problems of personality are fundamentally problems of religious adjustment, either of the person himself, or of his parents, or of society in which he lives. Have we the right to shirk our responsibility in this area? And then another point. It would be foolish indeed to expect friends in general to become amateur psychiatrists, though not more foolish than to expect medical men of infantile spirituality to become healers of deep-seated spiritual ills. They were some of the strong points she made in the manifesto. So the connection with Jungian groups came about in her meetings in New York with a group that Martha Yeager had brought together. Martha was a friend, and she was also a Jungian analyst, and she brought together Eric Fromm and Paul Tillich, among others, to discuss the ideas of religion and psychology. They were especially interested in Jungian psychology because he did recognize that religion and psychology go together. And she also talked about her visit to Jung in Geneva when the group, our study group that she was in there,
members of the meeting in Geneva.
Yeah. Okay. They were interested in Jung because Jung took religion seriously. His psychology was therefore relevant to the life of any religious group. The Friends meeting in Geneva, to which I belonged, before Irene Picard was also a member of, had discussions on the relationship of psychology to Quaker idea, the Quaker idea of the inward life. And we had discussed Jung with Jung himself. And the study group was interested in mystics. And Helena had volunteered to produce a paper on the mystical elements in Jungian psychology. It was a small study group, and there was so much interest in it that they asked to have another session. And so we had a second session, and that there was still more interest. And her analyst, Dr. Tina Keller, participated in the group. And in the spring, she arranged that we should go to Zurich and see if Dr. Jung would meet with us. He consented to do so, invited us to his home, so three cars full of us drove over and had tea in Jung's garden with strawberries from the garden. And there, for 3 or 4 hours, he discussed with us the relationship of Quakerism and Jungian psychology. I remember his saying that if he had had an early choice of Christian communities to belong to, he probably would have picked Quakerism. And from that was the link with psychology that was part of the early history of this conference, too. The link with the Connecticut Valley Association was a little more tenuous. Acceptance came gradually, but Lynette and some of her friends had to go to the members and ask to be taken under their wing. And the clerk did say that they were afraid of psychology, that psychology could cause problems. And Elena answered, but so can religion. And I asked her about that again, and she said, sure, everybody knows that if you take religion seriously, you may go crazy, or you may end at the stake, or you may start a religious war. Any number of things can happen. So, there's some of the early memories. I hope we'll have a later transcript of this interview on inward life, but that can certainly get us started on our memories.
Yes, I think Chuck would talk a little bit about the earliest conference and speak of this list.
Yes, it was a great surprise to us to find how many sources there was. Come down on me, the conference had sprung from Zeus's forehead or something. It was entirely, it was there, and we hadn't realized all the foundations that had been built beforehand. But now that we look back at what happened, we just don't see how they could have crowded everything into one weekend the way they did. Mentioned, this incidentally is from a history of the conference, which was written 15 or 20 years ago by Peg Thomas, and I'm disappointed that she isn't here. She hoped to be here, but I'm not too surprised. She had one of the hip replacement injuries, operations that didn't work. And she was expecting to be here on a walker. mentioned in leadership participation at this first conference on the nature and laws of the spiritual life were Elena Kochnik, outlining purposes and introducing the speaker, Dr. Stuart Hiltner of the Committee on Religion and Health for the Federal Council of Churches, speaking to the historical closeness between religion and health, stressing the profound difficulty of changing personality attitudes, and the need for a Christian psychiatrist. Douglas Speer guided the discussion of the Quaker heritage in group religious life in a panel made up of Robert English, Joseph Myers, Teresina Rowell, Laura Wilson, and Rachel Cadbury, discussed the development of the individual inner life. In case the name Teresina seems familiar, it's the same one. There were brief talks by John Collett, William Hoban, and Howard Brinton, the latter on the pastoral function of the meeting. The final topic, handled by way of panel discussion, was directed by Robert English and was spoken to by Martha Yeager, Robert Clark, and Eva Lewis-Smith, all professionals in the field of psychology or psychiatry. His final topic was training in pastoral psychology. Robert Clark is still one of our members and was regretful that he couldn't be with us today. I just was looking over a list that has been compiled of topics and speakers over the last 40 years. And just picked up, at our 10th anniversary, we had Fritz Kunkel speaking on religion, psychology, and education. And it was a landmark meeting conference in 1963 with Bernard Phillips, speaking on The Search Will Make You Free. And his pamphlet on that subject is still very well known. Douglas Heath, speaking on survival in a mad society, was in 1973. I won't read all of these names and topics, but I might mention that the most striking one was in 1950, when we had as our speakers Gerald Hurd, Paul Tillich, and Howard Brinton. And that was a two-day weekend and not a three-day weekend.
Or a four-day weekend.
I've also compiled a list of past speakers who are present today. And I noticed that Joseph and Teresina Havens are tied for first place, having spoken to the conference four times each. Silvio Fittipaldi twice and Herta Jocelyn twice. Others, John Youngblood is here, and Frank Cully, David Hart. I think Taylor Auten is registered, but I don't know if he's here. He is here. Rachel Hillel, and that's all. But I think Robert Johnson, at our 40th anniversary, is a very appropriate speaker for our conference.
Chuck, should we say that these lists are available, and anyone who would like one could speak to us, and we will provide it? We didn't want to just duplicate a lot of paper if people don't care. If they're interested, they're provided.
We like to think of our people who have been involved in the conference for so long as pioneers, and certainly Elinette was the pioneer that we all remember. I ought to say that Douglas Speer has been a pioneer in many causes, and it's particularly nice that he's here with us today. I was just thinking of him the other day in connection with the idea of peace cells, which I remember he promulgated, and a member of which I was. And I was wondering if he would have any recollections he'd like to share with us of that time.
Well, I think I'd just like to say a word to this statement of Elinette's here. I think Elinette perhaps was exaggerating a little the newness of all this to Philadelphia Quakerism, because actually Fritz Kunkel we brought over in 1936. I was with him in 1934 in Berlin, and we talked then of his perhaps coming, and then I was writing the Pendle Hill Summer School in 36, and I put up $400 there toward him, and dear Stella Skurlock from out in the far west put up her out of her own salary a sum about the equal amount, and we got some more from Elizabeth Howe, and out of that we were able to bring him, because poor Fritz just had to keep his own family going while he was out of office there in Berlin. He was here again in 39 and again in 43. He stayed over here in 39, his wife went back, and he was here through the war and got himself established out in the West. But I want you to know that Pendle Hill opened its breast to psychology quite early in the scene, and we had tremendous turnouts for these things in those times. And the one in 43 was an especially large one. And these times were times where I think friends saw what an enrichment there was there. I noticed that Ella mentions the fact that religion was afraid of psychology. If you think that is the order, you ought to see the other thing the other way around. Fritz Kunkel, because he had some religious interest, was not allowed to by the whole group of psychiatrists in Philadelphia. I couldn't find any way to get him. I wanted to have a meeting for him there. They wouldn't listen to him because he was a religious, because he'd been painted with religion. And he suffered from that all the time out in the far west as well. But finally, just threw the whole thing over and wrote his Creation Continues out of the Gospel of Matthew, giving the Gospel of Matthew an interpretation from the spiritual side, and showed us what tremendous possibilities there were of putting these together. So I wanted you to know that there were some things in movement that and within the Society of Friends, even. Although what she says there is certainly true, there were a lot of people that certainly wondered about all of this and why was this necessary, and were friends that neurotic that they needed to have this kind of assistance. This sort of thing. That was certainly there. I think you've so enriched the society by bringing so many interesting people of such a variety into the orbit here. Our resources at a place like Pendle Hill were very small, and that wasn't our kind of major thing, but Pendle Hill has been an experimental center from the very beginning. I thought of it was that it would be a place where Quakerism could face the new movements that were coming in and really find out what the significance of these things, take them into its own body, as it were, and see whether that couldn't be poured into the society. But you have so enriched this thing by the breadth of it all that I think we all feel deeply grateful to you.
There's no doubt but what all of us who have been attending over the years have come precisely because each time we came, we were enriched. That each year, I know, for us, for Chuck and for me, the conference ahead was something we were looking forward to month after month. And after the great event, then we had it in our mind to mull over and to share with our friends and with each other what we had learned and what it might mean in terms of changing our own lives. So that it's been enrichment is the right word, I think, for the conference. It opened doors from beginning to end. I think, Pat, you had something that you might share from having perused the early Inward Light, the very early ones.
Yes, I think I have, Eleanor, and I think it's kind of interesting. And as I told you, I was reluctant to bring up this thing because I thought it was possibly a very personal point of view. I don't go back to 43 with the conference. I think my own personal memory goes back to the wonderful meeting in which Martha Yeager brought Vanderpost to the conference, and that was held at Pendle Hill. And she was terribly excited because he came bringing us the myth of the praying mantis, which somehow devours its mate in the act of procreation. And very, very heady stuff.
Yes.
And Martha was living on the 11th floor of an apartment in New York City, and she had to go to the airport to meet Vanderpost, and there in her bunch of bananas that morning was a praying mantis. And that shook us all up, I remember very strongly. But I think that, well, that the curious thing is that so very often something in the outside world mirrors what is needed on the inside, and the inner work has to go on and is sometimes pushed by what is happening in the outer world. And as I read the inner inward light, as I've been doing for my own benefit and because Eleanor and I have a little project, it seemed to me, and maybe Douglas Steer will completely disagree with me, that it was World War II and all its great tragedy and darkness that made it essential for people to begin to look at the darkness within. And that if it had not been for the reports of the friends, the Quakers in England, who were struggling with the possibility of invasion, and what did they do when their houses and their families were being attacked? And there were very strong articles and editorials at the time about, do you become a pacifist or do you take up arms against Hitler? And there was very strong appeals to people to allow everybody to follow their own conscience and not to be judgmental. And there were families in which some people went to one way and one went the other way, and this was dividing people right down the middle. And I think this necessity to see the shadow in ourselves was accentuated by the great big shadow outside. Mm-hmm. And there was very great strength in that. And I think people were seeing this necessity to see that we carry within us the necessity to face this.
Mm-hmm. It was a very powerful incentive to get busy, get to work on our own selves and not blame the people out there.
That's right, not blaming people out there.
They were a mirror reflecting to us what we needed to do. What we were projecting on them.
Right.
We needed to bring it back and go inward and down.
That's right. And in the programs that Susan Yarnell and Rachel Cadbury and Emma Conroy had, that was the note that was struck over and over again. Don't blame them. Look in yourselves. And that was the note coming from England, from the groups that were meditating over there. And it was certainly the note that was being struck over and over again in the Guild for Pastoral Psychology. The blame cannot be put outside on the Hitlers. The Hitlers are terrible, but we have to somehow look within ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm looking a little bit at the time and realizing that there's more to our afternoon program and lots that we would like to share here. Perhaps we might, among ourselves, reminisce a little bit about personality. The one that we think of first and foremost, of course, is Eleanor. And I wonder if anyone has a story or an anecdote they would like to tell which would make Eleanor come alive for the rest of the people who didn't know her.
And it's very personal. Brother. Eleanor visited us once a week or weekend, and what happened then was we started making music together, and she sang Welsh songs and I played, but so I want all of you to know that music was important to Eleanor.
That's nice. I think the thing that startled me, I just have never considered what Eleanor looked like as a young woman. I was so impressed in person. And just recently, in the last week or two, 3 weeks, I've been hearing how beautiful she was. And Chuck remembers at the Friends World Conference in 1937 how lovely and clear her skin was and what a beautiful blonde head of hair she had. But several people have remarked at how lovely she was. So, of her, I just didn't know. I just wasn't aware of.
She still is lovely and attractive. I saw her 6 weeks ago at Kensington Village. She was
or if she's shrunk, she doesn't seem to be as tall as she used to be, but that happens to all of us. But she had this lovely light in her eye and smile, and her hair was arranged so attractively, and her clothes, the coloring was just right, so that she's still a beautiful woman.
She always was beautiful. I just meant that physically I didn't think it was. Anyone else have a memory they would like to share? Someone in the letter that we wrote to many people who were able to write to us but couldn't come. And someone said, maybe Anna said, that she had a wonderful gift at inspiring other people, bringing them together, having them meet one another at the conference or elsewhere, so that they could help one another and encourage each other in their work. And certainly she did that in terms of the life of the conference.
There seemed to be a certain magic about her personality that drew people, and they became committed to the ideas she espoused.
And then if we move on, I'm not sure who we would put second. There are a number of seconds, maybe a dozen of them. But certainly we want to mention Rachel Cadbury. For those of us who knew her, it was a special privilege, just as it was to know Eleanor, but a very different type of person, kind of person, a person to whom one could share one's deepest doubts and perplexities about God and about one's relationship to Jesus Christ and how one might work it out. You were comfortable in talking about the most sensitive subjects with her. She made you quite at ease instantly, and you could share, and she would have inevitably some lovely word of wisdom which you could go away with and grow with and work with. And I think also in the same breath of Susan, and I know that Betty has been thinking a little bit about a Susan that she knew.
I met Susan in her mid-80s.
I was in Yarnall.
And she was in her mid-80s and had the title corresponding secretary. I looked down the list of the duties. The duties she carried as corresponding secretary are now carried by membership secretary, spring conference registrar, information coordinator for the spring conference manager, and small group coordinator. Now, the conference here was small. The membership was not. The mailing was not. She did all the inward light mailing. I was a new, inexperienced member, and I liked plugging in the behind-the-scenes organizational work. And working with her, I developed a rich friendship, and I've always been grateful for it. We had some tall tales and a lot of adventures, because when you're working with small details, a lot of organization, the potential for error is great, and we fulfilled it often. Sending things to the wrong address was minor. We had utter strangers in single rooms with one bed between. It went on and on. But the wonderful thing was the way Sue could laugh at it. And I realized as I was remembering that she was somebody who taught me how to laugh at myself. And what joy she took in her own mistakes, not only in owning them, but celebrating them. It was wonderful. Harley remembered something before she was even corresponding secretary. She started as treasurer.
Yes, and was the treasurer for many of the first years that I was a member of the conference. And we were poor in those days, and Susan did not intend to waste one penny of our money. And it was accounted for in a series of notebooks. And we discovered that she was keeping our savings and checking account inside her savings and checking account with separate bookkeeping to save us the expense of paying for our own account.
And we have another treasurer here with us.
I might intervene to say that I was asked to audit Susan's books once. And I had never audited anything before. And it seemed to me it really wasn't very much of a problem. So I decided to make a joke of it. And I had read recently that there had been a terrible scandal on Wall Street, and that the firm of Price Waterhouse had declared that while they were responsible for looking at the books, they were not responsible for the honesty of the people keeping the books. So I averred that I had gone one step further and that I could avow for the honesty of our treasurer.
Well, then, I'm not sure, Lou, did you follow Susan? Was there someone in between as treasurer?
I think I followed the Joanne Ruby, Ruby.
She did it for several years. That's right.
Several years. Yeah. But I had just one little vignette of Susan Yarnold. Through some peculiar concatenation of questions and answers, Susan was pointed at, and Lou was pointed at, to speak to or with a group of young people in Baltimore yearly meeting. And we found ourselves driving the car. I was driving, and Susan in her 80s, sitting beside me. And I said, well, I'm hungry. I don't know about you. So we stopped at a restaurant. And she said, as we sat down, Lou, would you mind closing the door? The window is a summer's day. She said, I really can't afford to be in a draft at my age. And she smiled beautifully, and of course I did. But then we sat, and she ordered two pieces of toast and a glass of water. And I thought, that's not your meal, Susan, is it? Oh, yes, yeah, she said. At my age and my weight, she said, I'm less than 100 pounds. You have to eat very carefully.
I have to get back into one more thing. When the physical side reminds me, Susan, of course, had been a redhead. She wasn't when I knew her, but it went with her temperament. But she moved beautifully and well. She had been a tennis player when she was young, I think. When I was in her study in her old Germantown house, which had a long, long flight of stairs down to the living room, it was one of those old high-ceiling homes. And as I sat there, she was in her early 90s then, and she was in her house slippers. She had to go downstairs, and I can remember, way down, the rhythm and the liveliness of her step. And that was several years before her death, which I think was about age 96. So. Mm-hmm. But I always remember that rhythm going.
Yeah, I'd say that someone of her acquaintances told me, she didn't herself, but she was this friend of mine was so delighted that Susan Yarnold was young enough and courageous enough to take ballet dancing or ballroom dancing at the age of 90.
I didn't know that. I didn't get to know that.
We've had young spirits in us.
Well, she was a good model, certainly. Other names that we jotted down, of course, is Dora Wilson, is a very important early member of the conference. She was chairman. Lots of these, I guess Susan never was, but many of these early people were chairman, among other things. Does someone want to tell us a little bit about Susan, about Dora, and their memories of her at the conference and at Pendle Hill?
I mostly speak spontaneously, but I just wrote a note about Dora that I'd like to share. Some of the early participants who have left indelible impressions on me are Burr Wilson, one of them is. Her stately, lithe, and friendly presence gave assurance that her belief in the value of a deep and searching study of the Synoptic Gospels and an understanding of Jungian psychology would or could, and often did, bring transformation into one's deepest self, capital S. Her sense of humor, her intellectual integrity, her courage in facing a terminal illness left an unforgettable impression on those in the conference whose lives she touched.
And, of course, we perhaps should point out that it's her collection of books which made the nucleus for our library.
Yes, she gave them her collection when she died, or her husband did, and children gave them to the conference.
Gave them to the conference. I remember we were meeting, and he came and made that gift during one of the conferences. I don't remember which year. It must have been the following year after she died. Other names that come to mind, one is Ethel Walsh, who met with us for many, many years. She was an early secretary, and I'm not sure just she must have come before Francis was an early secretary. I'm not sure. Very early on, maybe the first conference.
I think she was a recording secretary.
That's right.
During the time that I was chairman, and I remember being grateful to her because her minutes were so accurate and so prompt.
If you don't mind going back to Dora, just let me say this one thing about her. Of course, she was one of our early Pendle Hill products. That is, she came to us as Bob's wife just a little after they were married. She was, her father was an Englishman and her mother Swiss. And this was a really, Dora never had a higher education or the kind of thing that we speak of over here. She did have a very good packing there. But I think we were so moved when Dr. Sharman was there. He was there for 2 years, our first 2 years at Pendle Hill, with this kind of thing that Walter Wink is doing today. And he terrified a great many people with his terrific questions that he would put. He never gave an answer, of course. Always questions, always probing questions. And some people just actually were so feared that he would question them particularly. When he died, when he left and went out to live in Carmel for the last years of his life, Dora took over. And Dora had all of his penetrating genius as a kind of Socrates putting these questions, but a very gentle kind of way, a beautiful way. And our saying around Pendle Hill was that we have profited greatly. We've gotten this, what is today spoken of, I guess, as a kind of communal exegesis. I think that's a wonderful term for it. We got the communal exegesis, but we got it with her beautiful, gentle kind of way. And out of it came, I think, probably the finest refinement, really, of it that we've ever had. With tribute to the other people that have done this, Dora's was, most of us feel, the finest way in which this was ever worked out.
I think perhaps we need to move on, even though we don't mention everybody. To remember that Dora also worked with individuals who had problems. She would counsel the people, and the people who worked with her, I can't say enough of how much that meant to them and how wonderful it was to be able to relate that intimately with someone as fine as she was, as understanding and helpful as she was.
And even till her very end, when she was dying, she had a spark there that still lit other people.
So many people came to see her during that part of time in her life. There's one person we haven't mentioned that we hoped would be here. I hope Joe will tell Terry that we miss her and that we wish she was here. But Terry was there back then, I guess before Joe was. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Before the conference was formed.
You want to say it again? Before the conference was formed, yes.
She was at the conference in Northampton. For the meeting when the whole idea was first approved by friends and sent on its way. And the one fact that I think is very interesting here, given this atmosphere of skepticism about psychology among the Society of Friends, the first name of this organization was Conference on the Nature and Flaws of Our Spiritual Life. Mm-hmm. It was not religion and psychology. You couldn't do that.
Yes.
Yes, Terry regrets very much.
Well, we miss her, but she certainly, I had the privilege several Monday nights ago of being at Pendle Hill when the McCandlesses, Molly and John, were talking about their life and what their Quakerism had meant in their life. And afterwards, Molly and Bernice Nichols reminisced about the house that they shared with Terry in Chester, and I remembered visiting with Kurt Watson, went to see Terry over there, and she took us around, took us to the restaurant where she worked, because of this conviction she had, wanting to relate to the people, the poor people, or the private people in Chester, and not just be on a head trip, but be out in the world and relating to it. This was a wonderful experience for me at that point. Chuck is noticing that I haven't talked very much about Martha, but I think that Anne did talk about her son. And I think maybe, I think we ought to stop at Quartet, that we need to just mention something about the change in the format that happened to the conference. In the beginning, out of what it grew was one-day workshops on meditation or whatever, and gradually we had, I think the first conference, was it one night or two nights? Was it two nights? As we know, we now have it over the Memorial Day weekend, so we can have the extra time. I think there was a feeling that there was, and we still have it, that there was never enough time to see all the people and talk to all the people and listen to all the speakers that we wanted to hear. And this is what's happening here is the result of growing out of the need that the conference felt as it grew along. And we have been remembering that there were lots of speakers in the beginning for a little conference or a short-term conference. We came to the point where there would be one speaker, and there would be, I remember, particularly a small group discussion. Not four, as we have now, but a single one, and later two, and eventually three and four. And I remember that on Saturday afternoons, we had creative activities. We had painting and sculpting and breathing, which I remember Chuck had great design. He didn't need to hear how to breathe. But
I'm a fifth generation friend.
And there came to be a time in which we realized that the important changes which were happening to individuals were happening when they were painting a picture in which they found they were saying something to themselves that they didn't know they thought or felt. Or in a discussion group in a safe, small group of 8 or 10 friends that would be sharing of experiences in relation to what the speaker was saying or where people were in their present life. And in the safety of the little group would come an insight of seeing something that somebody else said or painted. They would see something about themselves. And as a result, could share that. And something wonderful happened, and the whole group participated in that recognition and had a feeling of identity with it and a wanting to have the same thing happen to themselves. And at the time when Anna Morris was chairperson, the executive committee was very interested in this development, this possibility of making more of the small groups. And I can't remember which year it was when we had a conference for the first time when there was no outside speaker and only small groups. And I think there was a feeling that we needed the focus, probably, or we needed something to provide that, if not one speaker, then some of our own members. And gradually we did come to use our own members. But what I'm hoping that we can share, or that Rachel will share with us, is what happened when she came to the conference. And she might tell us how she came to come to the conference the first time.
Well, I'll try to be as brief as I can. Of course, it was because of Martha Yeager. All this time, I was functioning in New York City, although I had been always a Quaker, but I was functioning with other people who were becoming very deeply concerned just before the war of the prejudice which was increasing here. And we formed an organization called the Service Bureau for Intercultural Education. And then because of that, and I was also teaching a class at New York University in a class of teachers in intercultural education. And we would come out of the halls and could see swastikas on the you would think almost that we were in Germany. And Father Coughlin's voice from Detroit was saying, "This is a white man's Christian country." You can tell who he was cutting out. And so the teachers in this class were very worried about how they could affect the children when their parents were increasingly prejudiced. And so they said, what
what kind of a group experience can we have with adults? And I said, I don't know, but we're adults. Let's experiment on ourselves. And so in my apartment with that group of people, miraculously one night, I won't go into the details, but one of the young men said, I think we found a new way of coming together. And we called it group conversation. And the way was to get a group of people and have us begin to share our childhood memories around a particular topic. And so that was the essence of it. Well, then comes Martha, and she experienced this with us and saw the value of it. And then she, knowing that I was a Quaker, she said, she described what was going on here and among these folks. And so she said she felt that my own Quakerism will be deepened if I should come to this conference. And that and she wanted us to come and use our group conversation method. And so at that, by that time, Nusung Lee, who was Chinese in her background, grew up in Hawaii, was a part of our work. And so the two of us came, and we selected, it was the time Suzuki was here, in 1954, Intimations of Immortality. Well, we changed for our topic a little bit. We said, let's, and we had a group of about 30 people, and we called it Living in the Light of Eternity. And so we shared our early memories of birth and death and feeling of immortality, and it was so moving and so beautiful that it affected, I think, the whole conference. And so after that it was when they kept it going, relating small groups to the main topic. And I'll never forget, Suzuki was very difficult to understand his philosophy in many ways, but when that time he said, the difference between the East and the West, and he took as that the flower in the crannied wall, I picked you out of the wall. He said, only the Western people would pick a flower out of the wall and analyze it, root and all in all. He said, we would sit down in front of it and worship the beauty and so on. Well, that was quite moving. And only one other memory, which also includes Vanderpost, was that later with Vanderpost, he had as a part of his philosophy that prejudice is the result of self-rejection. And that was a very important concept to really understand and work on. And so we worked with him and with Ellen and so on. We got out a booklet called that, and I have in my files at home only 3 copies. I guess it's almost gone now, but it's still very relevant.
It's in the library. It's yes. Available to us. I'm noticing that the time when we need to stop is here. And I'm going to suggest, what did you say? I'm sorry,
as part of the
conference. Yeah, I think we have several things that we want to talk about, but I think that we're going to mess up the program for the rest of the afternoon if we don't allow the others to go. And if Elliot will permit us, we'll stay here and we'll do some more sharing because it's important to us. And we will come in late, perhaps, to the other meeting.
We're glad that Fern's still
attending. Yes, Fern is here, and we'll be able to talk. I want to say something to
everybody.
Oh.
Could I?
Yeah.
Okay. Could you wait just a minute?
Lana Rosenblatt wants to...
Let's try to speak for all of us. what out of what need came this conference? To what fulfillment has it led us? From door to door we walked, from gate to gate. Then not one of us knew winter yet. We learned here trust into the light or the voice, the comfort or the command coming as an opening. We learned that there were other doors or windows waiting to be knocked at, to be opened, sometimes to be entered for a moment, to take a hand trembling and tired in the long waiting and lead to door or window. We learned new dimensions of prayer. Lord, let my listening be. Let me sing answer while song is still ringing from the far mountain. We have come to know halos, the radiance of stillness, of sorrow, of joy in another's face. We have come. We have known the circle within our own arms, met and embraced by yours and yours. We have learned to know the meaning of pilgrimage.